So I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Red Thompson. I killed him.
Order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, episode 286. I feel like that was one of the old computer with 486, yeah. 280s.
80286. First 16-bit Intel processor.
There you go. Well, that's the theme. Change all your plans, Andrew, because that's the theme for today's show.
All right.
No, not really.
Deep dive into 1985 computing technology.
We are still in beautiful San Francisco on location where all the law is happening. That's why we're here. It's not a vacation. Who told you that? I didn't. Nobody said vacation. Nope. I didn't say vacation.
You're legal. The puppet. No puppet.
How's it going, Andrew Torres?
It is going fantastically well.
Tell me a quick question. First legal question. What legal remedies do I have against you for taking the last beer out of the fridge? I think I have standing.
You do. You have suffered injury, mm-hmm. in fact. In that you do not have a beer.
But I also didn't buy any of the beer. So I feel like that could be a standing issue. But did you buy any of the beers?
I actually, in fact,
bought this beer. Oh, you bought the beer. Okay. So I have no standing. I think we've discovered I have no standing. That's okay. Hey, that's what sometimes we get an easy one.
This could be, sometimes it could be intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Yeah, true.
My conduct
it could be fraud if you promised me one and then got me to donate to you.
Conduct here is extreme and outrageous in drinking this beer in front of you. So.
Okay, good. So that's a good starter question. Question two, tell us about, there was just as we were going to press here, like in between episodes, there was another Flynn document. This is like breaking for us. Obviously won't be so breaking for other people because, that's how time works. But breaking news, lay it on us.
Yeah. So in Friday's episode, we talked about the Michael Flynn sentencing and how he fired Covington and Burling. So they filed a motion to withdraw. In addition to filing that document, at or around the same time, a document is filed just under notice parenthesis other. Okay.
Oh, wow.
This is the reason in which that happens is because when you are on the federal CMECF, which is the electronic filing system, you have to select from drop down boxes the things that you do, right? And so this is thing.
One of them is like, I may have committed some light treason.
Yeah. That kind of thing. Right. Light treason is not in the box.
not one of them.
So this is just marked as notice other. And what makes it strange is usually when you submit a document, that document is accompanied by, even if you're just like submitting a piece of paper, you would write something with the caption on it. And you would call it a line or something else, right? You would say, hey, just giving this to the court, attaching this document. What this is one of the 302 investigation reports. It's been redacted from Mueller's team interview conducted by Peter Strzok and name redacted with Michael Flynn concerning his contacts with Russia. And so we talked about this at the end of the show last time, and I'm going to upload it to the OA to openargs.com to our directory. And I'm going to leave this 302 out there for folks to read. It, I think, confirms sort of what we said, which is this one, at least, strongly seems to minimize Flynn's role in the Trump administration and his contacts with Russia. And so, you know, I'm going to dig into it. It's a 10-page, it's two separate documents. I'm going to dig into it in some more detail. But between now and then, you can read the documents and take a look.
Well, that's a teaser and a half. I believe you've got other stuff to tease, though.
I am really, really excited about doing this case. It got bumped because you'll see when we get to the B segment. But the Supreme Court just issued an opinion in Mont versus United States, M-O-N-T. And, you know, you get these kind of silly New York Times puff pieces about, like, does John Roberts vote with the liberals? And again, mm-hmm. the answer that's been no.
No.
Yeah. Right. This is a case in which the 5-justice majority are 4 conservative justices and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, yikes.
And the 4-justice dissent is written by Sotomayor and joined by Gorsuch. So what
the hell is happening?
Yeah, it's a truly
clownhornvoting.supremecourt.com.
Yeah. So really, really interesting alignment. And it's neat to kind of go through and break down, you know, how folks that otherwise, you know, you might otherwise think, I know I can predict politically where they're going to wind up. You know, how did the conservative majority get?
Well, my prediction is this isn't going to be one of those political, like, it'll be a more obscure case, but that's my prediction. Yeah. I could be wrong. Thomas could be wrong.
Well, and we are going to tackle this in the next couple of episodes.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
All right, enough about stuff we're not talking about. Let's talk about what we
are
talking about.
What we are going to talk about.
Step one, Andrew was wrong. back when we were talking about the Pension Protection Act and that whole mess. Not G. Zachary Terwilliger, but Hardogenesis, whatever.
Yeah, Gordo Hardogenesis. I was describing the Pension Protection Act of 2006. I mentioned that 2006 was a wave election year. That's a stupid thing for me to have said, because obviously the elections were in November of 2006 and the Pension Protection Act was passed in August of 2006. So that, that was coming off of Bush re-election coattails. The Senate in 2006 at the time that this was passed was 55-45 Republican. And the House was 233 to 202 Republican. So was, in fact, a wave year. Democrats picked up 6 seats in the Senate and 31 in the House. But there was no liberal sort of influence there. I mean, you know, who knows? It was a bad election cycle for Republicans. So maybe there was impetus to get stuff done in a bipartisan way. But no, there was no Democratic pressure. It was not as part of a Democratic wave year. I was just wrong on that.
Okay, fair enough. Minor details. That's okay. Well, I was hoping that would be more embarrassing for you, but it really wasn't. So I guess we can move on, unless there's anything else you need. Okay. So I didn't get to gloat quite as much as normal on that. No big deal. All right. Well, we were promised the deepest of deep dives by one P. Andrew Torres Esquire. And here we go. We're gonna talk about the citizenship case. The citizenship question and how what a bizarre turn of events. I don't know what the answer will be because I haven't listened to the opening arguments yet because I'm in it, right? When will then be now?
Now.
But it is just knowing, you know, some of the background of what happened. I mean, I hope that this ends up being consequential because it'll make a good story. But so it has all this intrigue. I mean, longtime Republican, like, strategist guy, Thomas Hofeller, died and then his, like, estranged daughter, who, by the way, found out he died by just she happened to Google his name. That's how she found out he died. But went to go, like, check, did he save some things for me that I'd asked him to put aside? So she goes, checks out all his stuff, and finds, this isn't just like, oh, a file on the computer labeled Republican Ethel stuff, dot, you know, folder. It was like a bag of like hard drives and thumb drives. And I it's weird that you would need all that. Like, I think people should just use, I don't know, Google Drive, Dropbox or something. But I guess when you're doing covert operations, I don't know. So she found all that. And one way or the other, it ended up that there's information there about a study that he did to try to see, is basically research how Republicans can be even more evil in terms of their effective gerrymandering strategy. Like, could we gerrymander even better using this citizenship question? So I'm curious if this will actually have any sort of impact on the case. You know, does this lend any information to the, like, the motivation that, you know, a lot of times with these cases, it's like we used Trump's Twitter account to say, yes, this is a Muslim ban, you know, like that. Will it be that kind of thing where the stated reason, if I remember right, is, oh, we want to uphold the 1965 Civil Rights Act or whatever it is, the Voting Rights Act. That's why we're doing all this stuff, because, you know, us Republicans, we're all about civil rights and that kind of thing. So we're just helping you out with that. So let's get the Andrew deep dive and find out what's going on here.
Yeah, that was an excellent summary. Remember, we covered this case, which is captioned Department of Commerce versus New York, back in episode 232. So go back there for a little bit of a refresher. This has to do with the Trump Department of Commerce attempting to add a question on citizenship status to the 2020 census.
Again, out of the goodness of their hearts.
Right, right. Yeah. And the allegation is that that question is being added so as to deter people from answering the question who are either not legal citizens of the United States or who are adjacent to not legal citizens of the United States. And everything that is designed to reduce representation is designed like that, that we know statistically that favors Republicans and disadvantages Democrats. So I want, before we kind of get into the new stuff, I also want to make clear, because there's so much terrible reporting on this that I want to make sure everybody in our audience is armed with this. Point one, if you receive a census questionnaire, you are subject to the penalties of perjury. You must answer those questions honestly. Point two, the census is not a count of U.S. citizens, right?
Right.
It is, and it was initially governed by
the Constitution.
Section two, yeah. Right, of the Constitution, right? So section one says, you know, the legislature, Article one, section one says, you know, the legislative power is vested in the Congress. And then it says, here's how we get a Congress, right? And this was the famous 3/5 compromise, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which are to be included in this union, according to their respective capital N numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons, right? So slaves were not citizens, but nevertheless, they were counted, as 3/5 of a person for purposes of apportionment. Obviously, the 3/5 clause was superseded by the 14th Amendment, but the language just then replaced.
So that indicates what they were doing.
Right. They were counting people living in this country,
right,
not citizens living in this country. It was a crucial aspect of, you know, for, again, for your originalists out there, it was a crucial aspect to how the Constitution got passed. The 3/5 compromise, you learn about it when you're in elementary school and then again in middle school and then again in high school. So after that preamble, right, is, the actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years of the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. Right. So that is the constitutional mandate that the Congress needs to conduct a census every 3 years to determine the capital N numbers of the actual capital E enumeration of people living within the United States.
Hmm. Pretty clear. Case closed.
Case should be closed. Right. So there is, you can Google this. You can look it up on Lexis. There is case citation that says this enumeration must count all residents, regardless of citizenship status. Right. The enumeration affects the apportionment of representative to Congress among the state, the allocation of electors to the Electoral College, the division of congressional districts, the apportionment of state and local legislative seats, and the distribution of, quote, hundreds of billions of dollars of federal funding, end of quote. Okay. So this is a big deal, and the lawsuit is about the Commerce Department's transparent efforts to make that count less accurate so as to underrepresent Democrats. Okay. And that's been the goal since day one. And the lawsuit currently pending before the Supreme Court is a challenge, right? Because there really is. So there are three findings at the district court level. By the way, we talked about this in 232, but just as a reminder, this was one where the district court enjoined the use of the question, and then the Trump administration petitioned for certiorari before judgment, right? So skipped over the appellate court and went straight to the Supreme Court. The cert petition was filed in January and then granted in February. Oral arguments have already been heard on this case, which is going to play a role. And the government has requested that the Supreme Court issue its ruling by the end of June. So within 3.5 weeks.
So already I'm wondering, everything else being equal, timing wise, could these documents even come into play? Forgetting everything, like if they're the smokingest of smoking guns, could they still even come into play?
Yeah. And that's what we're going to break that down.
Sure.
Right. So the district court essentially made three findings, right? So first they went through, as we teased in our intro segment, right? First, they determined that there was actual injury, right? That plaintiffs had standing to sue on the idea that they would be prejudiced by being undercounted in the census. Second, that there was causation, that injury would be as a result of adding this question to the census.
Okay.
Right? And then the third and most crucial part of the district court's finding is essentially that adding that question is done for no legitimate purpose, right? Because that's the standard of the Administrative Procedure Act, right? We just read the provision of the Constitution, right? The provision of the Constitution says Congress gets to tell you how they're going to conduct the census. Congress delegated that authority to the Department of Commerce, right? And it says, as they shall by law direct. Right. There are no constraints on that.
Yikes. Well, that seems like the bad people are going to get away with it.
It does. Yeah. So the district court's finding, I thought, was incredibly well reasoned. And it is this, right, that undertaking was arbitrary and capricious because it ran counter to the evidence in the administrative record, failed to consider important aspects of the problem, and contravened established agency procedures without a rational justification.
Okay.
And then the court gives six different ways in which this was irrational.
Wow. Right?
But what that means is, and I want to be really, really clear on this, all the Supreme Court has to determine is, no, there was a rational reason for this.
Yeah.
Right? If there's one, and a rational reason doesn't even mean a good one, right?
It means
a non-idiotic one. Right. A non-discriminatory.
So there's really no protection against bad faith here. Like they can just say, oh, no, there's a reason. And then it's even though the reason was totally because the one thing we, non-evil Republicans had on their side in this is when you're trying to do something like this, that's clearly only for one evil purpose. It's actually kind of hard to think of a real justification for it that would pass any kind of scrutiny. But when you have a Supreme Court filled with people who may or may not decide they care about that, I suppose that could be the challenge.
Yeah. And whitewashing the history of this question is central to this case already before the discovery of the Hofeller documents we're going to talk about. So in March of 2018, Wilbur Ross, Secretary of Commerce, announced that he had decided to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census questionnaire. This decision, as the respondents note, right, the victorious plaintiffs below, contravened the Bureau's long-held opposition to such a question, disregarded the extensive evidence to the contrary presented to the Secretary, including the conclusions of the Commerce Bureau's chief scientist, right, that adding the question would harm the quality of the census count by reducing the response rate, right, and would produce less accurate citizenship data.
And they have I've heard a bit of a deep dive on how this works. It's really interesting because they have so many models and everything where they're trying to get because the data is, you know, obviously can be horrible in different places, and they have all these ways of trying to balance out, like, if we, you know, if we got this much response from here, you know, it's like a massive 538.com but for the census, and something like this throws a complete wrench in all of that.
Yeah. And the crucial part up until a couple of days ago was that Ross said, we added in the March 2018 memo, said, oh, following receipt of a December 2017 letter from the Department of Justice, that letter said, hey, we need citizenship data so that we can enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Right.
So can you please, like, look, this is just crucial for us to defend the rights of historically trampled minorities. This is how the respondents put it in their opposition brief. They say the secretary, number one, reiterated that narrative in his testimony before Congress. These descriptions of the secretary's decision making were misleadingly incomplete.
Wow.
As the secretary later admitted, in June of 2018, after this lawsuit began, the secretary acknowledged in a supplemental memorandum that the DOJ's letter had not initiated the assessment.
Right.
Right. Rather, the secretary and his staff had engaged in an extensive deliberative process about whether to add the citizenship question soon after he became Secretary of Commerce in February 2017. Right.
Yeah.
That's a week into the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they came in with an agenda.
They came in with an agenda.
Started doing it.
Right.
And then we're like, oh, they made us do it later on after the fact to try to justify it.
Right. This is, and again, this is undisputed.
On the record.
On the record. It's worse than that. DOJ did not submit the December 2017 letter on its own initiative, right? but rather, Secretary Ross called up the Department of Justice and said, quote, we request that you include a citizenship question in your request letter to us.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that is like a listener Thomas S.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's that level of deception.
It
right?
is. Oh, by the way, I got a question here that just came in. They're asking, why is Thomas so good looking? Could Andrew talk about that for a while? Huh. Okay. Well, I'm hearing about it, but, you know, the rules are the rules. So,
yeah. That's exactly right. So this is all in the record, and we could evaluate what role this would play in the Supreme Court's decision making. I would say I would be very skeptical of it, right?
Like, yeah.
A week ago, if you said, how do I think John Roberts is going to rule on this? Right. Because that's all we are. Every political Supreme Court question right now, you have to ask yourself, is the backlash on this in history textbooks going to be so egregious that John Roberts will swallow his desire to enact conservative Republican outcomes and side on the forces of correctness and fairness out of a desire to preserve the institutional legacy of the Supreme Court?
Because right? This isn't going to be like the what you teased in the beginning of the episode where Ginsburg is, you know, or anything like that. Like, this is going to be a straight up partisan vote.
This is going to be a straight up partisan vote. But now, 2 days ago, we got the Hofeller documents. And the way in which these come about is, remember that the Supreme Court granted certiorari before judgment to the District Court of the Southern District of New York.
Mm.
But as a complicated matter of jurisdiction,
ooh, one weird trick. Huh?
Yeah, this one weird trick. That court,
is it because that case never finished.
Yeah, so exactly. Right. Yeah. So the court still has jurisdiction over these supplemental aspects. And so what the plaintiff's lawyers did was move for sanctions, right? Say, yeah, you put on witnesses who have testified fraudulently.
Oh, because they didn't reveal
right.
that this existed.
Yeah, they said the opposite, right? They said, and we're going to talk about what they say, but
they said there's definitely not a dead guy with files and thumbs drives everywhere.
Yeah.
20 thumb drives.
Well, and so let's do that now. Let's talk about what the allegations are. Okay. It says we're moving for sanctions because we now have gotten new evidence that contradicts sworn testimony mm-hmm. given under oath of, number one, Secretary Ross's expert advisor, A. Mark Newman. And senior DOJ official who was acting assistant attorney general at the time, John Gore, as well as as well as other representations made by defendants to this court. The new evidence concealed by defendants strongly underscores the pretextual basis for their decision to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. Although the appeal of this court's judgment is pending, this court retains jurisdiction over collateral matters related to the case. So the district court, the trial court that issued the injunction in the first place, now gets to determine, okay, are sanctions warranted? Did you introduce lying testimony? And that letter, you are required by law to inform the Supreme Court, oh, hey, we sent a letter to the district court, because right. the Supreme Court has jurisdiction over the case in the main, while the trial court has jurisdiction over the
this is why I hope this all works out, because it's going to be a cool story. It really is. But it's not going to work out, so never mind.
So, Thomas Hofeller.
Quick Negatron struck in the recording there.
Hofeller is one of the key architects of REDMAP.
Yeah.
We've talked about him. We've talked about REDMAP a lot. We've probably mentioned Hofeller by name. He is described somewhat euphemistically as a longtime Republican redistricting specialist. In this internal memorandum, he says...
That's like describing Thanos as a longtime resource management specialist, really. Is it like that?
Yeah. A resource management consultant.
Consultant, like I'm trying to up my nerd cred.
Was excellent. That was good use there. In his own words, on a bullet point on a slide, he says... Hofeller says, adding a citizenship question would advantage, quote, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, again, more pieces for the of evidence for the, you know, nobody's so that, the villain wait, sorry, in their own
so
strategy.
That, I did want to ask you about what was actually found in all the thumb drives. I'm sure there's a lot we're not privy to that was found, but the stuff we are privy to, because there was some argument, and it might have just been, you know, the Trumpy people given the Trumpy argument, but like, that this wasn't really that much evidence of this grand conspiracy. It was like a study that he did in 2015, I want to say. So do you know much about those details of what was on the...
I know all of those details because these were submitted to the court.
All right.
August of 2015, the Washington Free Beacon, right?
Yeah.
Which is the newspaper you turn to when the Washington Times and the Washington right-wing garbage monster and the right and the Washington Examiner, when they all say, come on,
they're
the lizard people, right?
Yeah.
And the Illuminati. You go to the Washington Free Beacon, the last refuge for the conspiracy-minded extreme
The Washington Freedom Eagle Locker Up Beacon.
So Washington Free Beacon commissioned Dr. Hofeller to, quote, study the practicality and political and demographic effects of using citizen voting age population in lieu of total population in redistricting, right? So this is the foundational research. Hey, if we only look at citizens, what would the effect of that be on redrawing districts?
So it's like trying to gerrymander even more precisely.
Yes,
basically.
Right. Because this is the guy, right? This is the guy that was first asked, hey, how can Republicans use existing laws about drawing congressional districts to maximize their advantage? Right. And he was like, sure, I'll tell you exactly how to do that. And he did. And he wrote a computer software program that did that.
Well, wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Hofeller.
Hofeller was the red. That was red. I don't know that he wrote it.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah. But.
But he engineered
he was
plan,
part of
the
feasibility study, right? So that's what this document is. This is a feasibility study on changing how congressional districts are apportioned by, instead of looking at total population, which the Constitution of the United States requires you to do, look only at citizen voting age population. First, Hofeller writes, you can't use citizen voting age population, quote, without a question on citizenship being included in the 2020 decennial census.
Quote, flaming gun, flaming gun, flaming gun, smoking gun, flaming gun, smoking. I think I went for one step higher than smoking gun is a gun that's actually on fire because you just.
you are anticipating the next sentence.
The next thing, okay.
This is literally the next sentence. Even if a majority on the U.S. Supreme Court was sympathetic to the use of citizen voting age population for redistricting or reapportionment, the court is unlikely to permit such usage based on citizenship data from the ACS and would require instead an actual full enumeration on the 2020 census. Then Hofeller says, however, if a citizenship question were added to the 2020 census, the results, and again, quote, would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites, end quote. I'm going to quote from another section, quote, would clearly be a disadvantage for the Democrats, end quote. And third section, quote, provoke a high degree of resistance from Democrats and of the major minority groups in this nation, end of quote.
So it's, quote, when we do the evil thing, we've done study of the evil that we're going to do. We're going to need the Supreme Court to be evil. Might work. And we're going to need a rationale to include this question for evil doing purposes. Hope no one finds this. LOL. See you at the next evil meeting. That's my summary.
I did not want to editorialize because.
Leave it to me.
Yeah. Because look, their words are that bad.
Yeah.
Now, at trial, remember we talked, this affects the testimony directly of Newman and Gore. So, first, the Ross's expert, Newman, testified in a deposition that, and then there's redacted stuff, because again, there's potential for ongoing criminal harm. Newman testified that he did not rely on Dr. Hofeller for expertise on the Voting Rights Act, and that Dr. Hofeller did not appear to me to be an advisor to the administration at all. When asked about the substance of his conversations with Dr. Hofeller, quote, about the citizenship question in 2017, he testified that Dr. Hofeller said, quote, Mark, you need to make sure that we take a good census, that the administration doesn't skimp on the budget, end quote. Gore, meanwhile, testified that he, quote, drafted the initial draft of the letter to request the citizenship question sometimes around the end of October, early November 2017, and did not name either Newman or Hofeller as people who provided input on the initial draft. All of this testimony, as the respondents point out, is either misleading or directly false. In a congressional interview after final judgment in this case, Gore disclosed for the first time that in October of 2017, Newman gave Gore a draft letter as to how to frame this response, right? Then neither Newman nor Gore disclosed that Hofeller ghost wrote a substantial part of that letter. And that letter, you want to guess the punchline? That letter was the first time that the Department of Justice said, oh, well, you know, we need this in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So in other words, the Voting Rights Act excuse was created by Hofeller. That is also present in this document.
Jeez.
So Hofeller's right. Cause we just went through and Hofeller says, hey, look, it would be fantastic if we could use citizenship instead of actual voting, but like, that never going to happen. Even if we had a sympathetic Supreme Court, we would need to change the underlying data. Now, one way to change the underlying data would be to ask this question. And one good pretextual question, pretextual reason for changing this question would be pretending that we care about the Voting Rights Act.
This is the beginning of Austin Powers when it's like, it's not my bag, baby. You know, he's got the penis enlarger and it's, yes, it definitely is my bag, baby. Yeah, it's that, basically. That's the document we found.
Yes. Hofeller, using the Texas State House of Representatives as a case study, detailed how a switch from total population to citizen voting age population would cause districts with large Latino populations and or Democratic incumbents to disproportionately lose population, with the largest effects in South Texas, El Paso, and the Rio Grande Valley. Hence, Dr. Hofeller wrote, a switch to CVAP would reduce the number of districts in these regions and enable Republican mapmakers, of which he is the primary expert in the universe, to pack more Democrats and Latinos into each remaining district. He then explained, quote, Democratic districts could geographically expand to absorb additional high Democrat precincts from adjacent Republican districts, strengthening the adjacent Republican districts.
So more in the packing and cracking business, this is
more packing. Yeah. Right. This strategy could be employed to particularly great effect in heavily Latino areas because, and again, quote, considerable population would have to be added to a majority of the Latino districts to bring their populations up to acceptable levels.
Case closed. It's over. We won, everybody. We got it. Fortunately, this guy's dead. I'm glad he's dead. And now we got all the evidence. So there, case closed.
Yeah. So the bottom line on this, as the respondents say, those who constructed the VRA, the Voting Rights Act rationale, knew that adding a citizenship question would not benefit Latino voters, but would facilitate significantly reducing their political power. That's the whole point. He used minority voting as a case study of how to help pack additional Democrats into already strong Democratic districts. That's the evidence that has come out. I will link it, of course, in the show notes. Government's response was to say, nope.
Yeah.
We don't know. We've never heard of this guy. Yesterday, at the time of recording of this, so Thursday, June 5th, the district court had a hearing. The district court held that there was sufficient evidence to go forward on a motion for sanctions against the two government witnesses.
Oh, I was going to ask if that was my next question is, yeah, we know these guys lied and maybe we'll get this evidence because of that. But is there also consequences for these liars?
So, yeah, there will be consequences for these liars. If the plaintiffs prevail on their petition, that can be those sanctions can be anything the court ordered because it can force them to turn over money. It can hold them in civil contempt. There will be consequences. At minimum, at the district court level. Now, here's the part that I don't know that requires speculation. And this will either be a genius move by the district court or a terrible move.
Uh-oh.
And maybe having a super high variance move is what you want.
Need, yeah.
I don't know. But
emptying the net, pulling the goalie.
Yeah, that's right. That is a perfect analogy. So the order entered Thursday, right, was, and I'm going to upload it to the show notes, but I'm going to quote it from its entirety because it's nice and short. As discussed on the record at the conference held this afternoon, plaintiffs shall file any motion for sanctions or other relief, including any request for discovery, right? Because let me take kind of a sidebar here. Right now, they've got this smoking gun.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still more stuff, right? Like there's a
pile of them somewhere.
Right, exactly. So they can request additional information, right? Additional discovery to support moving for sanctions.
Right now, the evil people are like, does anybody else have any estranged daughters that are you?
Yeah.
Just check.
And serve it on any party against whom relief is sought by July 12th, 2019. So July 12th, 5 weeks from today. Whether by defendants or any non-party against whom relief is sought, that opposition must be filed by July 26th with a reply filed by August 2nd. At the time any reply is served, plaintiff shall deliver, blah, blah, blah. You may recall the Supreme Court recesses at the end of June.
Yeah, I recall that.
And the government has requested, and the Supreme Court will do this, mm-hmm. that it deliver its opinion by the end of June.
Okay.
So right now, I can tell you as a former state Supreme Court clerk, what has happened? Oral arguments were end of April. The court has already voted on this.
Really?
Yeah. And now that's not binding, right? You can switch back and forth.
Okay.
But there is a tentative division of labor. There is somebody writing the majority opinion.
Yeah, they got to start writing a bunch of stuff. Yeah. I guess that takes time. Yeah.
And that is due in 3 weeks from today. Right. Yeah. And so the question is, would it have been better for the district court to grant sanctions on an incomplete record? Right. Or would it have been better for them to postpone whether they're going to grant sanctions until the end of July? Now, this is the question there is not a political question, right? Because the political answer is super easy. This story, popped up, whatever, but district court awards sanctions would be a much bigger story. Mm-hmm. This has kind of flown under the radar a little bit. That's not what the Supreme Court cares about. The Supreme Court cares a lot about what this district court judge thinks. And by waiting, again, by proceeding prudently and cautiously and permitting discovery, knowing that this could produce embarrassing revelations, if this forces the Supreme Court to hold off on issuing its ruling, if this causes John Roberts to go, yeah, I know I voted with you guys, but I'm not comfortable signing on to that opinion at this time with this being up in the air.
Yeah.
This is one of the few instances, because the injunction is in place. This is one of the few instances.
Yeah, the census has got to go out.
It's got to get printed. It's got to go out. If the Supreme Court does not issue relief by the end of June, they can't add the question.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. They can't do it. Wow. And so it's a high risk. It's pulling the goalie.
I think I get it, but I'm not totally sure I understand. I get the reward part there, but what's the bad outcome that, you know, the other team,
the bad outcome is an empty netter. That the Supreme Court issues its relief in June, the citizenship question gets added, and then in August, right, we get a huge bombshell of, it's even worse than that, right? Like, here's the paper. It's sort of tough to imagine even worse evidence than what we already have.
Nothing we can do can get that evidence out faster. So you're just saying the other side.
The other option would have been to say that this is enough. Would say, yes, you have produced enough evidence for us to say that this is sanctionable conduct. And I think the judge said, boy, I don't know that that's going to be enough. If I just rule on sanctions right now, I think the judge's thought process was that is too easy to dismiss as being improvident.
Is there a possible interpretation that the judge is just like, well, we need to, this is how it should go.
Yeah.
Forget the Supreme Court. We should see more evidence before we do sanctions.
And I wanted you to get right. I wasn't trying to prime the pump on you on that. Like, I wanted you to get to that point. This is what a good judge who doesn't care about the political implications of this should want to do.
Yeah. Okay.
This is what you would do in the ordinary course. But I can't imagine that this judge is not aware.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court granted certiorari before judgment, right? Like, I mean, he knows this is a big, important case, and it's a high risk. It's a high risk strategy.
Yeah. Wow. What a one weird trick, kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
But yeah, because that census has to get printed. They are running out of time. The one thing that we have on our side is that they are enjoined from putting that question on the thingy. I just have to hope that, I'm not usually the optimist prime. In fact, I'm the Negatron. But there's part of me that thinks this is so bad that Roberts, because this is a history book entry. This is remember that time when they tried to just nakedly, openly discriminate against, you have all the phrases that you, non-Latino, white, what was it?
Yeah, non-Hispanic whites.
Non-Hispanic whites. Like, it's just so obvious. So this could, again, I don't hope for much in this world, but I could almost see this being too much for Roberts, maybe.
And look, let's couple this, right? So you're being an optimist prime there. I'm going to be a Negatron.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Let's couple this with the fact that in the next 3 weeks, an opinion is coming, a 5-4 opinion that Roberts signs on to that says, yeah, political gerrymandering is just fine. Right. We've talked about
that one was already.
Well, it hasn't come. Right. But he's signaled that that's coming.
Yeah.
So I think the what goes along with what you've just said is it may be a bridge too far for Roberts to say, yeah, gerrymander as much as you want, and also rig the data collection to make it easier for you to gerrymander. That may be a bridge too far. We may find out.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What a mess. What an evil mess. Yeah, so I just can't believe all the smoking guns. I mean, smoking guns, that is just a person. These files that were recovered are just Smocking gun. I mean, it just really is. Like, sometimes you think, oh, people really aren't that evil, or they're not trying to do. This is just the guy saying all the evil things they're trying to do. And just right out in plain sight now. And will it matter? Will it affect anything? We'll see.
Yeah. This is a gun made of other guns that shoot guns that those guns themselves are smoking. Yeah.
And it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And we begin with Peter Graham, On Hart, Noel, John, Corey Floyd, Martin, Bill Garthright, Danny Wheeler, and they pledge, so I have to say it, poop on a Confederate grave. Okay. You got that. You got your dollars worth. Your turn.
And thank you to DeVos, Amash, and Sears. Walk into a bar. Nice setup there. Jonas E., Vincent Omnia, Kevin Calhoun, Colleen Wilson, AOC, Why Won't You Date Me? I mean, debate me. Stop with the stop calling and just respect to people's preferences. And Chris Taylor, thank you all so much for supporting the show. If you'd like a shout out, head on over patreon.com/law. Give us as little as a buck and we will give you a shout out as awesome as this.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, now it's time for TTTBE, the answer. Oh, not confident in this, but I'm very interested to hear. Maybe I'm going to learn something. Here we go.
This was a super fun question. This was a torts question about an automobile accident. And it involved a child who was pushed.
Suing their own parents somehow.
Well, and I'm going to explain that part too. It involved a child who was pushed by a playmate out into the street, was struck by a car, and then at trial, the jury determined that the total damages were $100,000, and they split the fault three ways. They split it 50% to the driver, 30% to the parents of the child himself, and 20% to the parents of the other kid who pushed him out into the street. And then it notes, and this is the crucial part of the question, that the court in this jurisdiction has adopted two important rules. Number one, the comparative negligence doctrine. And number two, joint and several liability. And it says in place of common law rules. There's also a bit about intra-family liability that's a total red herring.
It is.
Okay. Doesn't have anything to do with anything. Now, Thomas, before we get into the answers, you ask, why would he sue his own parents? And the answer, as the which is in the predicate of the question, is that this lawsuit is brought by the parents' legal representative.
Yeah.
And the parents and that legal representative represents only the interest of the child. The interest there is to find everybody who might be at fault. You name everybody in a lawsuit. And so if his parents were at fault, it's in the child's best interest to sue the parents.
So the representative has an obligation to do whatever. It's not like the parents get a lawyer for the kid, right? Though, how does that work?
So that what happens is the court will say, we appoint so-and-so as a lawyer to be the official representative to act on behalf of the kid. And then the parents do pay for the lawyer, right? But the lawyer has to has to answer to his client. And here his client will then be represented by a truly neutral third party. So this is not that uncommon of an occurrence.
Okay.
Now, your answers were how much can the child's representative recover from the driver of the car?
Maximum amount. If anything.
Yep. So the options were A, $30,000, B, $50,000, C, $100,000, D, nothing. Thomas's second chance bar exam, you eliminated A, right off the bat, $30,000. There's no way to get to $30,000.
I didn't think so.
And I will tell you, patrons will get to see. Patrons always get not only the full text of the bar exam, but they get the answer key. I think the answer key screws up this question.
What?
Yeah, the answer key. I'm going to read it to you. It says, A, incorrect. This might be correct under a pro rata allocation of damages, but it's not correct under comparative negligence with joint and several liability. That's not true at all. We're going to talk about the two concepts that are tested here, but a pro rata allocation to the parents would not get you to 30,000, right?
Yeah.
Because the parents aren't 30% responsible.
Well, the parents are actually.
I'm sorry.
The driver.
Right. It would not get you 50. To 30,000 for the driver. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we're going to talk about that in a minute, but you eliminated A. It was a very, very good elimination. Could possibly be 30,000.
Yeah.
You also eliminated D, nothing, which is a really, really good elimination. Okay. And it gets to this question was designed to test your knowledge of two legal principles.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is the difference between comparative and contributory negligence.
Yeah.
And number two is the difference between pro rata and joint and several liability.
Yeah.
Okay. So nothing would be the rule under a contributory negligence doctrine, right? In contributory negligence, if you as the plaintiff are contributorily negligent to your own injuries, then you get nothing.
Wow.
Yeah. Specifies we're not dealing with contributory. We're dealing with comparative negligence. So D is also a good elimination. Mm-hmm. So then the question is 50,000 or 100,000. And I'm going to skip the suspense building. You got this question exactly right.
I think I got slightly lucky, though, now that I analyze it, because it's the joint and several liability is the key.
Exactly.
It's 50% because they were found 50% at fault. But because of the joint and several liability, the maximum amount is possible to get to the whole 100,000. Now, when would that happen if the other people have no money? Or?
Yeah. So joint and several liability means that we prioritize making the plaintiff whole. And then we require the defendant. So the plaintiff can recover the whole sum from any of the defendants.
And then it's up to the defendants. Would sue the,
exactly
oh, wow.
right.
I will admit I lucked into it a little bit. But I think I was most of the way there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's right. So here, even though the allocated sum to be allocated to the driver under a comparative negligence doctrine is 50,000, the plaintiffs can recover the full 100,000 and then force the driver to sue the other two for contribution.
I got lucky. It's funny though, right when this happens often and it makes me mad, right when we've sat for a bit, and then we come back to this, right when you start reading the question, I usually know somehow more about it. Like right when you said the joint and several, I was like, oh, that's why I knew it. Like right when you started reading the question and then, fortunately I got lucky and still got it right. That's a fun one. Yeah. Great question. And we're going to have to, most of all, I won, but we're going to also have to hop in the time machine and find out who else won, who's going to be awarded fame and fortune, just untold amounts of fame and fortune. I can't even told you about it. Who are they? Hop in that time machine.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
The winner of this week's TTTBE question is Heath Enright. And people are going to have to listen to the patron bonus to find out why Heath won. You can follow Heath at his house, because I don't think he tweets, or by visiting his website, latercheese.com.
All right, and I think we may have a little bonus for our patrons only, and if whoever's listening thus far, get excited. we are going to have some special guests answering that bar question. Maybe others, we'll see. Noted luminaries. Such as Eli Bosnick, No Illusions, Heath Enright of the Puzzle in a Thunderstorm group. They are in the house with us. We're going to see if we can get them on for a little bonus content. It'll be fun. It'll be hilarious. It'll be law content as well. Something for everybody. So that's another patron benefit, and I'm sure we'll push it even more at later times. But catch that on the Patreon feed. And that's all for now. What do you think?
Sounds good.
All right. We will see you Friday. We've already teased some stuff. I'm looking forward to that. See you then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.
There's literally an driving by the house in some sort of crotch rocket type thing, back and forth. Just back and forth. It's right outside our Airbnb.
Revving his stupid engine right outside the window. Yeah.
Cool. Where was I?